And there's another little told story about the Holocaust and World War II that's part of a new novel. Andrew Anselmi writes about Italy under Nazi rule in 1943. His mother grew up in Italy and suffered under the Nazis, even though she herself was not Jewish. She would never talk about it, so Andrew researched the events that took place in Italy during the war, and part of that is in his new novel, Iron Butterfly. Andrew says there are a couple of reasons most of us don't know a lot about the Nazis in Italy during the war.
I think it's multifaceted. I think in the first instance, you have Italy in the aftermath of World War II, not really prosecuting war crimes by Germans against its own citizens, in part because they had been allies with Germans, with Germany, and they didn't want to make themselves as a nation vulnerable to the same types of prosecutions. So I think you have that at the Italian level. And then on the Italian-American side, if you look at the Italian-American migration from the 1880s to the 1920s, the Italians who remained here were in the throes of their assimilation. They wanted desperately to be Americans. In my case, my mother didn't even teach us Italian. So I don't think anyone wanted to talk about anything on this side. They always talk about the other side and this side. They want to talk about anything on this side other than being an American in public. Privately, they kept to their rich traditions, and that was sort of the dichotomy. But I think that's what was happening on both levels. But now, as you've seen, Life is Beautiful, Roberto Bignini, Nazi concentration camp in Italy, Spike Lee, Miracle at Santa Anna recalls a massacre that took place in Italy. And even Germany, to its credit, has discovered in the last 6 years that the number of war crimes committed against civilians in Italy was double what they previously thought. It's more like 22,000 people now.
What did your family tell you about this? Or you said they didn't talk a lot about being Italian, but did anyone in the family talk about what happened during the war?
Well, that's really what spurred this book, is that whereas my father's side was a very proud Italian-American side, great success story, really gilded story, my mother was quiet and never went back to her hometown. So in 1986, I went back to her hometown against her wishes, found what I thought was her secret, which involved the deportation of her mother from America back to this town. But over time, I started to discover when writing these books, there was something more. And my mother would refer to how horrible the Nazis were. And she's never said a word more, despite my prodding. So I said, Mom, if you're not going to tell me, I'm going to make it up.
Is there any, what do you think the impetus was for the cruel treatment of Italians and Jewish Italians by the Nazis?
The conventional wisdom is that, you know, it was really due to the Germans either feeling a sense of betrayal from the Italians switching sides, or just the superiority that drove their entire, you know, their racial superiority. But I think more modern scholars, greater minds than mine, have added another layer to it, and it's really the fog of war, the insecurity of being ambushed as you're on the run, being chased by the Allied forces, that really caused a lot of atrocities against Italians in Italy who were not Jews.
How many do we have any idea how many Italian Jews were deported and or put in concentration camps or lost their lives?
I think the best figure that I have, Mary, and again, I'm not a historian, I'm a novelist, but and a trial lawyer, but the best numbers I have is that there were 40,000 Jews in Italy during the war, and 8,000 of them were lost to the Holocaust. And that was to concentration camps, mostly, I think, within Italy, as depicted in Life is Beautiful.
Yeah. Did you find when the book came out, were people surprised by some of the numbers? Some people really just did not know about this very much at all?
I think people still don't know about the numbers. I wouldn't have known about the numbers, but for the fact that I felt that my mother had a secret that I had to begin to chase down. So it's sort of the converse of Holocaust Remembrance Day. Holocaust Remembrance Day, we have the numbers and we can never forget. This story is one that's evolving and that we have to dig to find. And I'm sure we still don't have all the details of it. And I think people would be surprised to hear what happened vis-a-vis the German forces in Italy.
In the book, in the first part of the book, you read about this young man and he's going to London. He's sort of the all-American successful young man. He's going to college, he's doing very well. And then he goes home and sees his family. Was that any of that taken from your own life when you were growing up?
Absolutely. It was probably around 1986 when I was going to London for a year. And I had an episode with my mother before I left that she was crying and really worried why I was out so late. Maybe I got home at 11:30 at night. And it never made sense to me. And I said to my father before I left, we were eating ice cream at a place called Magic Fountain in New Jersey. And I said, "What's up? Why is mom so protective?" He said, "I don't know. I think it might have something to do with her childhood." So I said, "You know, Dad, I'm going to go back and find her town. I'm going to be in London for a year. I'm going to find her town in southern Italy." He said, "I don't know if that's such a good idea." But long and short of it is I did go back. It was a glorious, really great return. I wrote it down for her, gave it to her. She wound up going back herself several times and keeps in touch with those cousins now. But even then, I didn't have the full story. It kept peeling away, and I'm continuing to peel it away. And hopefully one day she'll tell it all, but I doubt that she will.
She's still with us. She's still around to see all this happen for you.
She is. And whereas she won't talk about this, she's more than happy to explain to you her recipe for eggplant parmesan, which you can see on my website. There's a video clip of her showing you how to cook it. She's all about family, food, and being together. And that's why everyone who knows her loves her so dearly.
Now, your last name, is that the original last name your family came over with? I know a lot of Italian people whose names were changed, or the family would change the name because they were worried about being treated badly.
It's so funny that you asked that question, because yesterday at Easter dinner at my mother's, appropriately distanced and most of us vaccinated, we were debating that with my aunt and my brother, who, you know, pretend to be the scholars or elders of the family. And there's one school of thought that says, within our family, that says Aunt Selmy was always, it was definitely changed when my grandfather came here. It had been Anselmo, but there's one school of thought that said it was changed to be more Americanized. There's another school of thought that says, no, that was our real name before Anselmo back in Italy. So I know my father, whether it was true or not, I think, and he's now passed, he believed that it was changed for Americanization purposes with the help of a school teacher. And I think the assimilations, I've just written a piece about the Italian-American experience the last 40 years and whether it's changed or not. And it's a complex phenomenon, but for Italian Americans, they were really intent on assimilating and not being discriminated against. So they were outwardly very upwardly mobile. They wanted their kids to be doctors and lawyers and professionals and to be very much like what they perceived as the establishment, to be part of the establishment. You had these really rich traditions, food and song and getting together, that continued to thrive within their walls. But now, for a whole variety of reasons that affect us all, social media, crisis and confidence in leadership, those traditions are fading away. There's some signs of hope that the Generation Z is reaching for them and for the Italian tradition in general, in Italy as well. So we can only hope that it will continue, because it is a rich tradition.
That was Andrew Anselmi, the author of the new novel Iron Butterfly, which tells the stories of the Nazis in Italy during World War II and the devastation they caused the Jewish population and others as well. And finally, today on the program, we have another small wonder. Today, we hear about what Jim Scopp calls a dark moment of Iowa history that took place more than 150 years ago at Lake Chautauq.
What's happening at Lake Chautauq? It's romanticized into sheer silliness. The only painting I have ever seen that concerns the massacre just up the road at Lake Chautauq, Minnesota, features fancy white horses pulling an ornate wagon packed full of ladies in Sunday go-to-meeting dresses while three gentlemen in suits and fedoras are running alongside. It's Downton Abbey in rural Minnesota circa 1862. There are no smiles, and the woman driving is switching every bit of speed she can from the steeds. Their hurry is concerning, as is the fear on all of their faces. More than 150 years ago, of course, I wasn't among them, but neither was John Stephens, who put this dark moment of Siouxland history to canvas. It's called The Flight. And his intent was to illustrate the tragedy of the massacre, for a massacre is what it was, of the white settlers who had recently put down roots around Lake Chautauq. What's remarkable is just how far it is from that string of cabins that once stood along the lakeshore to the place where so many people died, a place still referred to as Slaughter Slough, where the survivors, a couple dozen pioneers, took what refuge they could from the violence they wanted to escape. On the morning of August 20th, I arose and prepared breakfast as usual for my family, my husband, myself, Mr. Rhodes, who boarded with us, and our five children. Mrs. John Eastlick lived to describe that day. In but a few hours, no family was spared loss. Those who escaped the attack took flight towards New Ulm, 50 miles away. With the killers in pursuit, the survivors determined to hide as best they could down in a slough where the big blue stem grew tall enough to conceal them but offered no cover from the rifle fire that soon rained down. 15 white settlers, three children from the same family, never stepped out of the place after the fight that followed. Eight women and children were captured somewhere down the hill beneath the commemorative rock that still today marks the spot, an open Siouxland prairie. Just about a century ago, a monument to the slain was constructed over the mass grave of 14 Lake Chautauq victims. Visit the park sometime. You can't miss the monument. But it's easy to miss Slaughter Slough. If you're so inclined, take the gravel. It's the only way. You'll have to hunt to find the place. When you get there, almost certainly you'll be alone. The place never did draw crowds, I suppose, and still doesn't. And maybe that's a good thing. Stand out there and look over open miles of prairie, hundreds of acres of it kept original and native by the National Wildlife Refuge System, who maintains restored wetlands. The silence all around is fitting. Is there a statute of limitations on tragedy? How long should we leave the monuments people erect to mark the places loved ones once died? Should there be a time limit on grief? In May, Lake Chautauq is full of fishermen. Who really cares about the bloody murders of homesteaders or the outright thievery that marked America's manifest destiny? So what if my ancestors took virgin land from those who lived there? That's 200 years ago. I say make a visit to Slaughter Slough. In the company of the endless sunflowers waving in incessant winds, a trip out there may even be good for the soul. Once in a while is okay. Get out there and listen. Try it sometime.
I give it all.
Support for Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media comes from the Daniels Osborne Law Firm in the Ho-Chunk Center in downtown Sioux City, serving the needs of clients in real estate transactions, business formation and guidance, and personal estate planning. More information is available on Facebook or at danielsosborne.com. Well, that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith. I'm Mary Hartnett. Have a great week.